Hello and welcome back to season 4 of Listening to the Dead. Now, while this is a full episode to start the season, it's also a teaser episode really, because the rest of the season won't be landing for another couple of months, as Linda here is busy writing her much anticipated autobiography, which will be out in September. We're going to start this series with an episode on fraud forensics. What is fraud? How has it evolved? And how are the police attempting to track and capture the shadowy figures responsible for around 3 million scams in the UK last year alone, worth over £1 billion? That's about one case for every 20 people in the UK, or the equivalent of one every 12 seconds. It is a vast and complicated subject, but fortunately, Linda, Cass and I have joining us today two of the country's leading experts on fraud. First, we have Tony Sales. Once one of Britain's biggest fraudsters, Tony reformed in prison and emerged to lead one of the country's largest fraud awareness organisations, We Fight Fraud, which advises companies and governments on fraud prevention. Think of him as Britain's answer to Catch Me If You Can's Frank Abagnale Jr. And as you can imagine, with a life that's that colourful, his autobiography makes for compelling listening. It's out now and it's called The Big Con. And we're also joined by one of Tony's colleagues at We Fight Fraud, Andy McDonald, formerly head of the Special Investigations at the Counterterrorism Command and member of the Fraud Squad at the Met. With over 30 years in detective roles, Andy is a leading financial crimes and risk management expert. Well, thank you for joining us, gentlemen. We wanted to start by looking back at the evolution of fraud. It is, of course, one of the oldest crimes, as early as 300 BC. Two Greek sea merchants engaged in an insurance scam, setting the precedent for modern insurance fraud. But let's begin our look at fraud with you, Linda, because before Tony was committing fraud and Cass and Andy were investigating it, you were writing about it in your book Seekers. What do you remember about researching for that book? What was fraud like back then?
Because it's written at a time when there really wasn't all this computer fraud, it was dealing with a wife, mother, discovering that her husband had a double life. And this is quite an extraordinary, dramatic moment, because you're understanding how somebody can live for a very, very long time, years, be married to somebody that is completely fraudulent. Everything about them is a lie. And in this case, he had another family. And for my research, I went to a lot of wives of people's husbands, partners who had been imprisoned for fraud. But I really directed most of my writing in the shock that happens to people when they begin to understand how much their life has been living under a lie. It is so shocking, because they then mistrust everything, and they mistrust close people around them as well. And in Vanished, you see how somebody can move under the radar. And in this day and age, to be able to, as I said, live under the radar, and you go, well, how would you do that? How would you commit a fraud and just literally not be traced? It means that you are not connected to any form of computer. You don't belong to anything. You don't have a driving license. Or if you do, they're not in your name. You have nothing with your home address on. There's no bank account. There is nothing that can be traced, because now, within a flick of a computer, they've got you. You know, and in, you know, to be able to track someone. So when you say somebody lives under the radar, they pay no tax, they pay no VAT, they live an absolute, usually cash life, and they can move around with cash. They have numerous false identities, but as long as they are not actually signing any document, they're clear.
Let's bring in Tony there, the man who has lived such a life. And in fact, Tony, the interesting thing there is that what Linda's crossed there with her two books, Seekers and then Vanished, is many years apart. You're looking at analog and then digital fraud. Mm. And Is it easier now because it's all digital, or is it easier then? It was much more personal, but there were less tracks.
Yeah. So it's a lot easier now than what it ever has been before. The internet just kind of turbocharged crime in a way that probably no one expected. So the processes have always been there, you know, like Andy and Cass in their older careers would have found out ways that criminals are applying for identities, like Linda said, and been able to put processes in place that then stop that from happening. So one that comes to my head is that birth certificates, you know, were a keen thing. If you hadn't had a birth certificate in the UK at some point, you could go, deaths and births weren't connected, and you could slip in, get a birth certificate of someone that had deceased, and then start a new identification, right? That law then got changed. The criminal evolves and says, okay, I'll get an identity mule. Who's never had identity in the UK and whose birth certificate can I use now? Then you get the organised ones that go, how do I get an enabler who works in the registry office who's going to give me them like that? I know everyone born before 92 is not on the computer system. Now I can just open up passports, whatever I want at will, in multiple different names all over the place. So nowadays it's all done online. You know, like those processes are still there. They still exist. And yet now they're online, much easier for someone like my old self to create these crimes. And of course you have phone calls, you have social engineering, you know, it's all human problems and human processes there.
So that was just, Andy, that for a long time, the essence of fraud is about identity, is the fact that if you have someone, you're always been after somebody's identity because that's the keys that unlock their money.
Yeah, John, it's really interesting. First of all, thanks very much for having us. And if you'd have told me 7 years ago that I'd be sitting with Britain's greatest fraudster in my front room breakfast table talking to you about fraud, I'd never have believed it. But there's a reason for that, actually, because one of the things that, if you listen to what Linda's saying, it's a doomsday scenario. Fraud is so easy to commit. It's out there. The internet enables it. So many people are affected by fraud. I remember Brenda Fricker in your series a long time ago. I can remember all of that. And fraud's been around for ages. You're quite right. If I said to you, what's the biggest reported crime in the UK at the moment? Fraud. What's the biggest unreported crime? Fraud. Law enforcement puts 2% of all its resources at a maximum to it. Should it be a bigger priority? Probably. But then maybe it shouldn't be, because normally you guys talk about homicide and, you know, the worst thing that can possibly happen to an individual. But I tell you what, I've seen people who've ended up dead from fraud. Yeah. And it really is a terribly impactive crime. Unfortunately, the bad guys understand this. That's why I work with people like Tony, to understand from that perspective that Cass and I, despite our 400 years experience in policing or whatever it was, just simply don't understand, because we don't think like that. And getting a different perspective from that criminal perspective helps us understand. And that's perhaps the biggest problem. We do understand traditional fraud, and actually the new versions of fraud, online, perhaps enabled, they're pretty much the same as the old ones. Just what's happened is the criminals have adapted, and that's where law enforcement now needs to learn a bit. And learning from people like Tony can be really, really valuable. But yes, techs change things. But the bottom line is fraud is just basically a scam, and then people want to make money out of it. So there's some traditional approaches that law enforcement can do, simple things like they say, follow the money. But also you need proper investigators. You do need some tech to help you. And what we have seen is that law enforcement have adapted the ways that they approach fraud, and they're beginning to understand it. And it's really important, because there are hundreds and thousands of victims out there that perhaps don't always get the response they do need to get.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So actually, we'll take that back. Cass, did you find that when you were back in Plumstead, you were called in to investigate fraud, but was it just part of your job to investigate any crime that came to you across your desk? It wasn't that you were specialising in fraud at that point.
At one point, I can't remember, Andy probably knows better, when the actual main fraud squad started, central fraud squad, but if there was up to a certain amount limit, yeah, then it would come across your table and you would investigate it as a CID officer. So, for example, I had one where it was to do with when it was a GLC, and it was applications for student loans, which only came on our desk because a guy from the GLC was so fed up going to different police stations trying to get somebody to take it, that eventually came in and just dumped it on the front counter, and myself and another officer ended up investigating it. But it literally took us, what started as we thought a few thousand pounds false applications for these loans actually spiraled, and we ended up going all around the country, and it got up to near half a million, and that was in about 1987-88. And it just, we thought, well, this is just, it got too much. But the irony of it was, if somebody had actually sat down and checked those applications, there were spelling errors, there was all sorts of different errors. If they'd actually checked themselves about the dates of birth and where and origin, they'd have found they were all false in the first instance. So yeah, that kind of thing we dealt with. But the big sort of main fraud, banking, that kind of thing, was the Central Fraud Squad.
Investigating that, did you get any training, or did you just have to
No training at all. I mean, Andy might agree, but I suppose the only training we got to an extent was that as detectives, when you went on a detective's course, you had to learn things like the Theft Act inside out. So you had a kind of like a little bit of understanding of what fraud was and the elements to look for to be able to charge somebody or prove your case to that extent. But no, there wasn't any. You literally, in those days, you learnt on the ground.
Yeah, John, I might be able to just clarify that a little bit for you. Cassie's absolutely right. But the big thing then was you did used to go on a 12-week detective training course.
Yeah.
That doesn't happen anymore. And pretty much is on the hoof training. They get some basic training. You don't get training in fraud. I went on a 3-week fraud course many moons ago, I think in the mid-90s. They don't do that anymore. So specialist training, just as with any other crime type, you know, particularly homicide, the expectation is if you're a detective, you understand it because you're trained in crime. That's not always the reality. There is some great bespoke training out there. And I suppose if you looked at things like the crypto issues that are now with cryptocurrency, there's some specialist agencies work together with the police to make sure that the cops who are investigating it actually are quite enabled to do that. So there is some really great specialist training out there, but it's not what you get as mainstream training within law enforcement.
We're very aware of these calls coming in to people and requesting their bank details. The naivety of people when they're told this is your bank manager. And they're very clever because they've got all this digital. So if you'd like to speak to the manager of your bank, you can press 2, and it's just another member of their team or whatever you call them. But I was just thinking, you know, this morning I get a call, like they're selecting aged, fragile, a living alone. They seem to have access to information that they've got a vulnerable being on the end of their line. And the other day I got a joke sent to me on my phone, which is actually Prince Charles telling a joke, but it's a filthy joke as well, but it's his voice. This is now going to be, isn't it, another added point to these fraudsters giving these cold calls, if they can actually be able to tape record even their bank manager's voice, but somebody they trust. And I think, I don't know how this flood will happen, but I don't know how you can stop it.
Yeah, so Tony, that's sort of the point, is the fact that it's always been about if you can fraudulently obtain somebody's data and pretend to be them, then you can, you know, start to access their money and their, but with AI, which is what Linda there was describing, is the fact that you've got somebody's voice, perhaps you can start to sound more like them. So is this are we opening it's the next chapter is now starting to evolve.
It is, but at the same time, live suppression is not that great yet, so like it's really difficult to spoof someone's voice that you trust perfectly. So if someone is vulnerable, perhaps an older person, they may fall for that sort of thing. But at the moment, that's quite a rare process because, you know, most famous people have deep fakes happening to them because there's lots of footage out there of famous people. Hence, they can get more words into the AI creator, allowing it to talk freely. It's dangerous when you've got, I've actually used it, so it can make, I've just done it recently where it made me speak in French. I've never spoke a word of French in my life, but it gets absolutely every part of my voice correct. Even the tone is just unbelievable, and that can do it in any language. So it's going to come eventually, and we're already seeing being able to kind of spoof live video, but again, the suppression needed and the memory needed to make it happen live, it's just not there yet, but very soon it will be. And these are all problems and issues, you know, like Linda's talking about one part of a fraud that's happening to one part of society. So what they'll be doing is picking via dates of birth, right? Looking at the year of birth, who's the oldest people on there, and targeting that one part for a certain part of a scam. But then you can go to any social media site and you can try and buy stuff. You know, if you go on these marketplaces, there's people paying for cars that they've never even seen because their desire is of such height, they believe they're going to get a bargain in that moment that it plays on what they want. And so we've got all of these different factors coming in, plus all of the normal interactions. Andy just showed me a message that says, "Hi, Dad, my new number." And we've all heard about the WhatsApp scams, right? So there's lots of different types of ways that the criminals will target phishing emails for businesses and consumers.
Where is that money going? I mean, there are these call centres apparently in India and everything. So is it going a circuitous route, or is there a hub somewhere where people are employing runners to pick up that cash? So where is that money going? That's cash, because it's always wanting them to move money, withdraw money, but I need to know, where's it going? You know, you always say in crime, follow the money. Well, how do you follow it?
Well, that's a very good question, because that's one of the things we'll get to in looking into this forensically, is how do you follow the money? I know in your book, The Big Con, Tony, you talk about moving money between bank accounts. And so part of what your team did was create more bank accounts to be able to hide the money. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, the banking nowadays, it's like, obviously, if you're the criminal, yeah, you need a bank account to get the money out or to turn it into crypto. That's what you're going to be looking to do, right? So the more accounts that I can get, the more money I can make. So the criminal goes online to social media sites again and starts to advertise, "Would you like to earn £1,000 today?" Yeah, to loads of different types of people. They connect to all of their networks and they start telling people that they've given them a percentage of the money that they're going to put in their account. And of course, they open up multiple different types of accounts. Yeah, so we used to see, starting to change a bit now because Companies House is starting to get a bit better, but we used to see criminals would just hammer new companies to open up bank accounts because no checks. Like, you can go in, there's no ID checks in the bank, open up a bank account online. The banks are happy with the KYC of Companies House, that everything's okay, and of course a company's opened up. Yeah, it's changing, but it's still all different across the board everywhere. But once I've got a bank account, the data's already out there nowadays. It's not like when I was a criminal, I had to find information to be able to commit my crimes. Nowadays, there's been so many hacks take place globally around the world that the data is already for sale. So I can go onto a site that sells data. I can buy someone's full bank account information with all of that person's information, their passwords, everything. And the only thing I might not be able to do is get the OTP that's transferred via the telephone number, yeah? The criminal then sidetracks that and goes and does something called SIM swap, because I've already got all of the information needed to walk into a phone shop and turn that person's phone off and get a new chip as that person. And now I can go back online and force the OTP, of which I can then transfer the money. But I need all of those accounts to get that out. And this is how they do it. You know, that's why we see the phone calls of them ringing people. There's multiple different ways and different things that they're looking for the information. But, you know, we always say if you cut the head off the snake with the bank accounts, they can't get the money out. You know, you're forcing them into a way that's really difficult. It's getting harder and harder to get money in crypto legitimately because they want proof in, proof out. You can still do loads of other bits to circumvent it as the criminal, but for those that are chancing their luck, it's getting more and more difficult. But you know.
I think if you try to unpick what Tony's just said, it all sounds really complicated, but actually it's not. It's a really straightforward scam. That dreadful thing that Linda's described happening to the people that she knows, really it's a thing that's called courier fraud. It's been around for years. When I was head of the fraud squad in sort of just after the London Olympics, 2012, 2013, we almost had an epidemic of courier fraud where typically vulnerable elderly people would be contacted either by the bank or by the police, and there would be something wrong with their account. They would then either be talked into giving details over the phone. That's how it first started. We did some awareness campaigns, and that stopped a little bit because people became more aware. But then they just changed. They evolved. And then suddenly you'd have a police officer would turn up at your door. And that would then be the next part of the scam. What you've got involved here is vulnerable people. And you're quite right, Linda. Typically, unfortunately, the elderly do tend to get focused on by the criminals. But increasingly worryingly, also young people get targeted as well. It's not just about elderly people. Now, young people are becoming these money mules that Tony's talking about, where you can make a bit of money by allowing us just to put a bit of money through your account. It's money laundering. You're going to go to prison for it. That's the message we have to get across. And what we've seen is a slight change in vulnerability where it always tended to be aimed at elderly. We've now got a whole range of people. It's certainly facilitated and enabled by the internet because that gives remote. But as Tony said, really all they need is then a bank account. And then with a number of bank accounts, what they do is they move it through 23 different bank accounts within about 2 minutes. Yeah. It's then gone out of the country. And then people like Cass and I in our old roles find it really hard to follow the money. And it takes months because that's a legal process. So
can I ask something? Because, Tony, you said something, you know, get the head of the snake.
Yeah.
But this is multiple snakes, isn't it? There's not one person.
It's just organised crime, Linda. It's still going into a bank account, whatever that process is, We always say that onboarding is the most important part for any business, You have to know your customers perfectly because otherwise this is what's going to happen. The bank account's always going to be the out for either organised crime or the chances.
Back in the old days, it would be that good fraudsters, some of them really bright guys, good at what they did, you know, no computers or anything like that, but they generally tended to get caught because they got greedy. They wanted more. They'd made a million. Why did you need, you know, another million? But conversely, I wondered, do some people get had over because they think they're going to make a fortune?
Right. So this is probably where Tony and I started within our relationship because I didn't want to work with Tony. He probably didn't want to work with me. And we had this sort of conversation. And we said, well, how is it you know so much about crime? Because you got caught. And Tony completely honestly will say to me, there were probably a few things I made mistakes. And some of that is you probably overdo what you could have done. If you'd walked away with some of the stuff, we wouldn't be sitting here today.
Yeah.
And there are, of course, aspects. But, you know, different parts of your life mean you do different things. I mean, Tony's far better place to do that. Yes, we do need to understand the people, these criminals and fraudsters. Yes, some of them are very bright. Most criminals, I'm sitting here with the person I introduce as my friend now. He's my subject matter expert in social engineering when we're working together. That's how I consider him. It's his different perspective and his knowledge, which is really valuable. And yeah, my former knowledge was great 15 years ago. I've had to change the way out I am. And understanding how Tony thinks, understanding how other people, particularly from a tech perspective, thinks, now helps us do what we do with We Fight Fraud. Things change. You have to be able to change. The criminals change. Yeah, it's fine that Tony has access that nobody else has to the criminal background, but things are changing all the time there. We rely on Tony being able to access that new information. The bad guys will change. But if you look at scams as a whole, there's nothing that new. Just a slightly different version of it, tending to be enabled by tech to make it fast, to make it difficult for law enforcement to follow quickly. However, what I would say is that tech does enable law enforcement to do things a bit better than it used to. Because when it was cash, it was really tough to follow. Very, very difficult.
So fraud is probably the crime that evolves most of all of them, right? It's constantly evolving. It's as the scammers trying to find new loopholes, weaknesses in the system and all of that. And to sort of keep up with that, I can see you guys doing it, We Fight Fraud. You've got this team to do it. But we still look at the police and think, have they got the resources to track this sort of incredibly fast movement of money, this laundering of money, and track it down? Like you said, it's out of the country before you know what's happened.
Yeah, well, then that's a legal issue, because as a British cop, you can't just suddenly have access to accounts in France and elsewhere. There has to be a legal process. The criminals know that. They've always known it, to be honest. It's just because tech enables the transmission of monies to be made very, very quickly, you can literally ping it around four or five jurisdictions within seconds. So that's four or five legal processes that the cops have to go through to evidence. We can learn about it quickly. We can understand that it's happened, but evidencing it is really, really tricky. So for me, and I never thought I'd ever say this as a 30-year detective, prevention is the key. I used to love investigating crime with Cass. It was great arresting the criminals, putting them in prison. But nearly all of my work now is actually about trying to stop it happening in the first place. And that's tough because we do have vulnerable people. And it's a bit of a vicious circle, isn't it?
Yeah. It's interesting what you said about there's no new ones, in a way, because I saw one headline that there'd been a 29% jump in romance scams last year. Where people pretend to fall in love with their victims and then ask for money, which feels like a very old scam. And it's probably just evolved to online dating more now. And
Linda's first story, isn't it? What she said. Like, it's the same, that, you know, that's a romance scam, just with a fraud star doing it for live in real person. Actually, you know, he's convinced someone that she's fell in love with him and then broken that heart the whole way through it. So, you know, it's like what we say, there are no new ones. Tech just enabled that, and these apps everywhere enable that.
We have to be careful not to victim blame as well.
Yeah.
Because it's really easy to say, how on earth did you ever fall for that?
Yeah.
Through my 30 years of dealing with all sorts of victims across all sorts of crime types, you'd never know until you become a victim. You know, I'm sitting there on my phone, I'm just shown Tony. I've got umpteen texts, emails. They're targeting me, the former head of the Met's fraud squad. And the fact that I don't fall victim to them is because I'm situationally aware, hopefully, that I'm not going to fall for them. Yeah. Vulnerable people do fall for these. We mustn't blame people. Yeah. I worked on a catfish type investigation for TV recently. And the woman there was the most sensible, reasonable woman in the whole world. But she thought, because she'd been dragged in by the bad guys, that actually she was going to get a date with somebody very famous. And it was never going to happen if you took a step back and thought about it rationally and reasonably. But this poor woman, because of everything else that was going on with her life, just was hanging on to a hope. And the fraudsters got involved with her. Everything you just talked about, she lost money. She opened up accounts, which they then misused for money laundering. Things just developed really, really fast. And it's actually difficult for us to just say, oh, it's as easy as just do this, this and this and everything will be okay. Yes, we can give good advice. It's really important that everybody's situationally aware of what might happen to them. But you guys wouldn't be saying to everybody routinely, say, don't walk down the street because you might get murdered. Well, yeah, we know that could happen. Not everybody has become a victim of fraud. There are some simple things you can put in place for both yourself and your company, which hopefully will stop you from becoming a victim of fraud. But it might still happen. And you've just got to sort of think rationally all the time, do the best that you can. And just like any other crime type, do what you can to prevent it happening in the first place.
That's interesting, Andy. That I remember watching a program on telly about what you were saying, and it was like a dating agency, and the scammers were playing on people who had suffered grief, who'd lost their wife, their husband, and I think one of them who was actually on it was a policeman who'd lost a lot of money, but he just wanted companionship, and they just played on it. Yeah. But again, it was one of those ones when you looked at the pictures, if somebody... You know, you look closely, there was evidence there, the pictures had been doctored, but that wasn't on his mind to do that. This was, you know, I'm going to meet somebody who's going to give me a bit of companionship.
We test companies all the time, right? And Andy will tell you that on the phone, I've opened up bank accounts without them ever seeing a piece of ID, just because they gave me one piece of information that I was able to manipulate, yeah, and twist round and go around all those processes. So, like, that company then becomes a victim of social engineering, of which I may have 50 other jobs going on as a criminal in the background that I'm looking to get one load of money through to that one account that I've already worked and opened up, right? So I'm already good with my mouth to open stuff up. And that's what criminals do. They'll write scripts. There's no difference, Cass, to the wine traders that would have, the Wolves of Wall Streets of the days that have been around doing this stuff for all these years. It's just got bigger because of the internet, the databases of numbers, the WhatsApp groups, the Signal groups, the Telegram groups, all these groups that exist all over the place that have thousands of people's phone numbers in them and information. That's all because we share it.
I did a thing the other day. Please don't tell me I should have done this one. On Have I Been Pawned? I was told it's a legitimate site, and I was quite. Yes. I was surprised.
It's not what Linda thinks.
No, because you can check. And I was quite surprised how many times some of my stuff had either been passwords, etc., had been sold or hacked.
I'm on Team Cass. Team breaches, I'm in my personal email address.
It's a really good point, Cass. Everyone should go to Have I Been Pawned, and just search your email address, and it tells you where in there, what databases it was lost in and all that kind of stuff. You know, the guy that started it is a great guy. We know him. It's a really good bit of kit, that is, and we suggest everyone should go and do that.
That's very good advice. Thank you. Actually, it brings me to one of the cases from last year that was so important that I wanted to discuss, which is the iSpoof case. So it involved a guy called TJ Fletcher, who was 35 and the founder and leading administrator of iSpoof website, which allowed criminals to disguise phone numbers before it was brought down last year. Tony, was this it's been talked about as being a massive moment for combating fraud. Was it one of the websites that was doing a lot of damage?
There was lots of criminals using it for sure. Obviously, the that's a great investigation. I've actually met the guys that have done that investigation, and they're amazing guys. What they've done was wow. Even down to going back and leaving messages for the fraudsters and people that were going back to the site, they just bantered them because that's the sort of world that these criminals live in. And it's really impacted. The problem is for law enforcement, is the very next day there's 20 of them pop up. Because that's nothing. That's one person, one administrator, who's probably not as connected as what it's made out in all of the media to what's doing. Because the people that are using it are the brains behind what they're doing. They're the people that are out there hitting all the victims. His service is facilitating it, but he will only be a small part of a massive jigsaw puzzle. Just like, I've spoken to active criminals that actually have their own ones. They're not even on no system. They've got it already on their own that they can, just like Linda said, press 2 to talk to the bank manager. Hey, you're through to Tony here, calling you from Nunts the Bank. Like, that's how good and advanced they are at doing this stuff nowadays. And it's definitely a thing. But that, for me, was an amazing thing, because what that done is showed the criminals that the police ain't having it, and they're coming after the likes of those sort of guys, which up until that point, they hadn't even thought was happening. So it was great.
I think for me, well done the Met Police and all the other police services around Europe that did it. But if you went back to it, actually, it's just courier fraud that evolved. Everything we talked about with Linda talking through, getting the phone call, it's online. And it goes back to, what are the criminals really after? These days, the criminals are not necessarily looking to steal your cash or all of your nice stuff that you've got. They want your data. Because if they've got your data, they can then use identifiers to then target others. With this one, the criminals were just looking for that personal identifier, which in this case was a SIM card, the SIM number. So your phone number. If they can get your phone number, they can then target you along the lines of what courier fraud is anyway. It's just it's enabled online. But this was exactly the same as thing. We used to have a thing called Confidential Access, which was a website back in the early 2000s, one of the first sort of websites that were being misused by criminals. And they were offering dodgy IDs, dodgy documents, dodgy passports, dodgy driving licenses, a phone number, all of which the criminals could use. Again, it's been around for ages, just I spoof was the latest version. But yeah, let's not take anything away with it. Fantastic result, impactive against the criminals. But sadly, as Tony said, following day, they're straight back into it. It's very similar to the EncroChat thing they had with the phones. Mm-hmm. The criminals misuse tech, we know that. Tech's great for everybody, but the criminals misuse it. Now, the criminals in this case were misusing the ability to get a SIM card. On the EncroChat, it's the ability to have a phone where you could talk to each other, seemingly totally encrypted that law enforcement couldn't hear. But guess what? Because the criminals are misusing tech, the law enforcement have managed to learn more, working in partnership with private industry. Actually, we can crack that tech. And once law enforcement can crack the tech enables them to investigate far more straightforwardly. And again, a great great result on that, where they've been taking out significant organised crime groups. So tech does work both for the criminals, but it can also work for law enforcement as well.
So for what you've been saying, it's sort of prevention is the key to this, to try to stop fraud. And then after that, once it's gone beyond prevention, law enforcement's really trying to play catch up always. It's trying to, because criminals are always evolving fraud, and then it's up for law enforcement to try and catch up if they can.
Simple process, John. Everybody, whether you're an individual or you're working for a firm, try your best to identify and understand all the threats and risks that are out there. And that goes not just for fraud, for any crime. Once you've done that and you understand them, put things in place to stop them happening, you know, manage and mitigate them as best you can, and hopefully to prevent. If you can't do that and the worst happens, you do become a victim, it's really, really important that people report fraud. Now, we could probably do a whole podcast on action fraud and how things have not gone well for action fraud. There's been lots of bad press. But at the moment, and it will continue to be, it's still the one place that to report fraud. And it's really, really important that if people are victims, they do report the fact that they're victims of fraud. Otherwise, law enforcement can't understand the true nature of the problem. They can't understand and analyse all of the trends and typologies that are going out there. We won't see the great operations which iSpoof and EncroChat were. iSpoof, one of the things there that I noticed about it, that there were nearly 5,000 victims actually did report to Action Fraud. And because there were so many, the police could understand it better. So it actually enabled them to do a better investigation. So whilst you might not think, you know, reporting to Action Fraud is the greatest idea because nothing tends to work, it's still super important that people do.
Yeah. Just follow up there on iSpoof for me, Andy. How did the police, how would they have addressed that investigation? How do they have reversed the sort of traffic of flowing out of iSpoof to get back to who controls iSpoof?
Well, the most important thing is you can't do any understanding or analysis unless you've got the data. So that comes back to people reporting it. So that's the only way the police heard about that was by victims reporting what had happened to them. So they've got a base to understand. But then what they saw was, actually, this is really, really common, because the one thing criminals, we did say, they get a bit careless. They do manage to get some money out of victims, and they do the same thing because it works. Now, that then gives law enforcement a chance. And what they did do, as I understand, is they had a number of reactive options, which were victims report, we'll investigate what's happened to them and we can prosecute. That's pretty much what Cass and I did for many years. But they also did a lot of proactive options as well. As Tony said, they did pose as potentially people were looking to use their services. So there was a proactive approach as well. Mm. But they could only do that because they understood what was going on. And the only way they understood that was because people reported it. So, and it's a bit of a circle, but that's what we call the intelligence cycle. Unless police know about it, they can't actually do anything about it. When somebody's been injured or murdered, everybody knows about it because it's been reported, and you can launch your investigation from there. If there's not a full awareness, you're always clutching at straws. So it's really, really important to understand, you know, the depth, the various nuances and the complexities of fraud, that people do report it, even if their report isn't one of those that's taken forward, because it's all part of the intelligence picture.
Yeah. Fascinating. Fascinating. Linda, do you feel more armed to deal with fraud now, to write about fraud?
Not yet. It's been so informative. And I do admire the both of you, actually, for what you're doing. I also wonder, just how many officers now we have in the Met doing the fraud. That's their priority. And I don't think we do have many. We don't have enough, and we don't have enough finances put into it, because it's a very, detailed, long search to get to a result. You know, you've got a lot of tunnel vision before you can open it. You know, get the head off the snake. I love that expression. But I think your openness today has been really, for me, very, very beneficial. And I thank you both.
I don't know how much has changed. I don't know if you felt the same, Andy, but I quite often, you know, the frauds that I did deal with in the job, you know, when we were, you know, in that sort of 80s, 90s period. I mean, some of the amount of money the fraudster was making that you wouldn't recover. But what used to really get me was, at the end of the day, if they got found guilty, the sentence they get was just ridiculous. Do you think?
Yeah, you know, Cass, it's improved a little bit, but it hasn't improved much. Offline, I could say all sorts of things. I won't be at all negative about what the police are trying to do about anything these days. So I think there's quite enough negative stuff out there. I think the sentencing guidelines have changed a bit. And even when I was working in the counterterrorism arena, if you can give the court the context, like the impact statements and stuff like that, this has been the impact of this fraud against the victim. That helps. And I've certainly seen sentences for frauds increase over the last 4 to 5 years since I've retired. But I remember when I was in, yeah, we had terrorists or people on the fringes of terrorism committing fraud to make crime, to fund their terrorism. And actually, if we can give the court that context, then they did get hammered. Yeah. And again, so there are things that can be done traditionally. And I think there is a better awareness of fraud from government through industry through to private individuals. Everybody knows it's not a victimless crime anymore. You used to be able to insure against fraud. You can't do that quite so straightforwardly these days. People know it's not a victimless crime. I think understanding the true impact, particularly when things are going through the criminal judicial process, is really important for the court to understand. But yeah, I'd agree with you. It's never going to be the same as somebody being assaulted. It's never going to be the same as traditional offences when it's sentencing.
Yeah, and we used to laugh. I would laugh at it. Like, I'd laugh at my mates that I knew that were drug dealers. Yeah, like, you're going to go get 20 years, mate. You know, off your head, I'm getting 6 months. You've got the same money. Like, what? What are you going on about? Like, I don't get it, mate. You're mad.
It's worth reminding people, Tony, what you did get.
Well, allegedly what I got, John. Yeah. 2 coppers on here. allegedly 30 million. But, you know, I always say that nothing what I did I'm proud of. I did stuff because I had my upbringing was pretty rubbish. I was thrown in at a situation where I had to survive, and I just didn't want to be me. So I found the best way not to be me was to steal other people's identity, and I could make money at the same time. And that took me a whole lifetime to understand who that person was and why I was doing it, to unwind that person. And to sit here today with Andy as the ex-head of Fraud of the Met, and talking to Cass as his old colleague and the staff, and Linda, I never envisaged anything like that could possibly happen ever just by telling your story and just being real about it. Like you said, I've just tried to be honest. I don't like the victims. I hate the ones that go after the elderly. I'm coming after them. I'm not having it. Like, and we'll definitely out this stuff.
It's a great story. It's a great story, Tony.
Just one other thing. I think some years ago, and you might know as well, Tone, there was talk about major frauds that you wouldn't have juries. A judge would try it. What's ever happened to that, and how do you think that would be the right way to go? Because, I mean, putting a fraud case together took a lot of time and effort, and the problem was getting people, a jury, to understand exactly what they were listening to, and quite often staying awake during a trial that could last for weeks.
Yeah, and that's always been the problem, yeah. And so the Serious Fraud Office have got some new powers they've been given at the end of last year. And again, they're having similar conversations. So that's great. It's going to give us better powers to put more things through the criminal judicial system. But at the end of the day, we're going to get 12 people that come from normal society that don't understand fraud, that don't understand the complexities. Except there's still a great legal argument that there ought to be some professional panels in place. Even if it was a point to see, does it reach a threshold test where then evidence needs to be put through? unfortunately, we've got this point in UK law where you're entitled to be tried by your peers. And that's really difficult to get. I know I sort of agree with that myself, but it doesn't help when, quite right, you've got a six-month trial where after the first week they're all switching off because it's actually really technical and really complex, and do they really understand it?
And well, it's Newton trials for everyone then, isn't it? Like, that would be the thing. It'd be a
Newton hearings trial. Is
Newton
everything.
Newton hearing, like, you know, that would be... I mean, I've been kind of saying for a while, I think we need an actual fraud agency. I think there needs to be one in the UK. I think the MPs need to have a bit where they can just sign off quickly and they totally understand what they're doing to enable, you know, the cops to then cut to the chase and get done what they need to get done. Because what I've learned is, you know, Andy's got a slide that he shows when we're at conferences, and it shows the bureaucracy and red tape that he has to jump through or had to jump through as a copper, and how easy it is for me as the old criminal to just cut to the chase and not have to go through any of that. So, you know, we blame the police because not enough happens, and yet their hands are tied. How are they meant to do anything? It's not fair. It's not a fair economy for that side. So we definitely need to get better at doing that stuff.
Yeah.
Yep.
That has been absolutely brilliant. Thank you all so much. Tony, Andy, what a lesson we've had in fraud. And I think we're all going to be a lot more aware coming out of this. Linda, Cass, as always, an absolute pleasure. And we'll be back in a couple of months with the rest of Series 4, when we'll be exploring four more forensic disciplines. Be sure to subscribe now so you don't miss the alert when it drops. Just time to remind you that the final book in the Jane Tennyson series is out in July. It's called Whole Life Sentence, and it's definitely one you're not going to want to miss. And you can pre-order it now in all formats. And Tony's autobiography, The Big Con, is out now in audiobook and includes a special interview with Tony. And if you want to report or learn more about fraud, then we can recommend visiting the We Fight Fraud website, which has some fantastic content and tips, and also Action Fraud, Take Five for Fraud, and Stop Scammed UK. And then the final one I'll mention is the one that Cass mentioned on the show. It's haveibeenpawned.com, and pawned is spelled P-W-N-E-D. They're all really good resources you'll find online. And you can find links to all of these in the episode description. Until next time, thanks for listening.